Hi, everyone. Welcome to the A6Z podcast. Today, we have one of our special guest-hosted episodes as part of a new series where we share select A6Z partner appearances elsewhere here. This one is with A6Z co-founder Mark Andreessen. The episode is cross-posted from the new show Starting Greatness, hosted by Mike Maples Jr. In the show that follows, Mark shares some rare behind-the-scenes details on his journey to product market fit from zero to one, from the University of Illinois and Mosaic to Netscape.
So it was a strange time. There's an old William Gibson quote, the author of Neuromancer, all the great science fiction books. He says, the future's already here. It's just not evenly distributed. And so this was a great example of that.
That's Mark Andreessen, who's now a famous venture capitalist at Andreessen Horowitz. At age 22, he founded Netscape, the company that kicked off the internet age. How did Netscape even happen? And what was it like when it was about to blow up? This is Mike Maples Jr. of Floodgate, and it's go time with Mark Andreessen. Welcome to Starting Greatness, a podcast dedicated to ambitious founders who want to go from nothing to awesome super fast. When you're a startup founder, you have to channel your inner James Bond, your MacGyver, your Wonder Woman. I'm going to help you win by curating the lessons of the super performers, but before they were successful. So without further ado,
ignition sequence start.
Let's get started. I decided to do some things a little differently with this interview because I wanted to capture things about Mark's startup journey that most have likely not heard. I wanted to get a level deeper about how Netscape and the early web grew out of the Mosaic project. But I also wanted to help people see a side of Mark that few people see in public. While you might see him share books he likes on Twitter, it's hard to connect this to what it's like to spend time with him. He's an incredibly avid reader in diverse areas like technology, science, art, literature, science fiction, history, politics, economics, psychology, and he can synthesize ideas and connect the dots in a blink of an eye. And that curiosity combined with his technical depth is definitely a superpower. If you've wondered about the origin stories of the web, what it was like to be in the middle of it, Mark goes into a depth that I haven't seen before. And he also reveals the three things he wishes Netscape had done differently that would have made the internet better today. I'm excited about how the conversation went and hope you enjoy it too. Let's talk to him. Mark Andreessen, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So, Mark, you've been involved with some pretty big wins. So why don't we just start out by asking you, what's your advice to people who want to build something great?
So the first piece of advice is don't do it.
It's impossible.
It's impossible. So it's so hard. Sean Parker has the best line on starting companies. Starting a company is like chewing glass. Eventually, you start to like the taste of your own blood. And so don't do it. And the reason that's the first piece of advice is because, number one, if you can be talked out of it, you definitely shouldn't do it. So if you listen to advice, number one, you definitely shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
If you ignore advice, number one, you might have the personality type to be a founder. So that's the first gut check. And then you see this a lot, I'm sure, is there are a lot of people who would like to start a company. The goal is to start a company, and then they kind of try to back into an idea.
Yep.
We call this sort of synthetic. We call these sort of synthetic startups.
Yep.
It's like, I want to start a company, and I am now going to apply myself.
Market white space companies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Boy, wouldn't it be great if X, right? Yep. Where X is just something I, you know, read in a magazine that day, or, you know, just a, you know. By the way, there have been some successful synthetic startups. Like some have worked. The more common thing is an actual, honest to God, organic idea that is actually something that you are like deeply immersed in.
Yeah.
Right. The odds that it's going to be like a flash of inspiration are very low. But like, if it's a field that you've been working in for 5 or 10 years and you know it inside out and it's just like obvious to you that it should work a different way, you know, then maybe you've got something.
Yeah.
But you got to like really deeply, like number one, you have to deeply believe because you have to really be irrationally committed to it because it is so hard. But the other thing is like, you have to actually validate your beliefs. Like it has to actually, like you have to be right.
And Gates and Jobs were the same way in PCs. You're obsessed with a field for its own sake and you start noticing things. Yeah. Because you're down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And it's very hands-on. And you know, both the Microsoft and Apple founding stories, both companies started very small and very humble because they were literally working, like, in, you know, Apple, they were building their first computers by hand.
Yeah.
You know, there was no abstraction to it.
Right.
There was no master plan. There was no theory. It was, can we build 100 computers made out of wooden boxes and sell them at the trade fair? And it built out of that. But they, right, to your point, like, they were living in that world.
I would love to just know about just how you got to building Mosaic. How did you get involved with the internet in the first place?
So it was... was a strange time. There's an old William Gibson quote, the author of Neuromancer, all the great science fiction books. He says, the future's already here. It's just not evenly distributed. And so this was a great example of that. And so what I sort of semi-realized when I chose to go to Illinois, part of it was because they had a top flight engineering program, computer science program. But in particular, they were picked in the mid-80s to be one of four federally funded centers for supercomputing at the mm-hmm. time. And this was a specific government program that basically had two parts. One was to basically buy these, you know, $25 million supercomputers from companies at the time like Cray and Thinking Machines and basically put them in, you know, basically four locations in the U.S. And then, you know, for scientists to be able to use for drug design and studying black holes and doing all kinds of stuff. $25 million computer, you know, occupied a full room. And in fact, in those days, what they would do is they actually build an entire building for the computer. And then they would actually, they'd build the shell of the building. They build the walls. They'd leave the ceiling open. Then they'd lower the computer down through the ceiling up, but using a crane
yep.
to lower it into place. And then they'd finish the building. So this was a big deal at the time. These things were super expensive. And so they only put them in four locations. But they wanted other scientists and researchers all over the country to be able to use them. And so the part two of the program was this program called NSFNet. Mm-hmm. So it's National Science Foundation Network, which was the funding group that paid for this whole thing. So those programs were authorized in the mid-80s. And then I got to Illinois in 89. And so they basically had been rolled out at that point. And so Illinois in those days, it was like a fully broadband wired internet native campus.
Wow.
And it was one of exactly four of those. But just because they have the internet doesn't mean that it's actually all that useful for anything, yeah. right? That there's, and you know, like if you're a scientist, like how exactly are you communicating with with your colleagues on different campuses? How exactly are you, you know, storing and analyzing your research? How exactly are you going to share your research with the world? That stuff was all yet to be built. And so the purpose of this group was to build, you know, basically to build the early systems that would let people collaborate.
So then you're building these early systems. Where does the idea for the Mosaic browser come from?
So funny story there. So basically, the project I got hired in to work on was a project called Collage, which basically was sort of, I don't know, maybe Zoom's the current comp or something, or you know, Skype. So sort of general purpose real-time conferencing, uh-huh. right? So video, audio and video, but also like what, you know, it's all the standard complement, whiteboard sharing, you know, document and collaborative document editing, Google Docs kind of thing. You know, this is like what, in 1991, 1992, right? So they kind of had all those ideas back then. It's one of those funny things. Like it's when people talk about this, but like the role of timing in this stuff is always so interesting because like that stuff's all happening now.
Yeah.
Right. Like Zoom goes public now.
Yeah.
right. It's like 30 years later. Right. So, you know, the lag on these things can be quite something.
Okay. So you're trying to help these ideas take some early baby steps. How'd you think about what to work on?
Well, there were a few things. And so then you basically say, okay, real time isn't going to work. It was sort of internet variations on the bulletin board systems of the PC hobbyists in the mid-80s, right? And so it's sort of those ideas being transplanted to the internet, which is kind of what all of social networking has been doing for the last, you know, 30 years. There was that. And then there was this new thing called the web, which had been, you know, developed in Switzerland at CERN. But that was like super early. And yeah. there were like, I don't know, two or three websites at the time. And like the software was like, you know, just it was just very early. And so if you would read like an article about, you know, the internet at that point, the article would be like, well, why would anybody want to use the internet? And then a lot of the articles just ended there. But if they would go on to describe why you might use the internet, it's like, well, you can kind of do email. And then there's this FTP thing. You can download files. And then if you really want to get weird, you can like be on Gopher and Waze. You can like go to Gopher and view menus. You can go on Waze. You can do searches, you know, kind of clay to be molded. And so basically the original idea for Mosaic was, okay, how about the universal client, right? How about, okay, because the problem is like all this stuff was like, these were all fragmented programs. They were hard to use. They were hard to install. Like most of this stuff was open source. It was like you had to be pretty sophisticated to install it. By the way, it seems obvious that like everybody's going to have this stuff. It seems obvious that kids are going to want to keep using this stuff once they graduate from college.
Yep.
It seems obvious that there's going to be, you know, software on servers and clients that's going to be used to share information. It's like, why wouldn't you be able to have a link? Well, number one, you don't have a text-based display because you want to be able to read stuff.
Yep.
Like most computer UIs up until that point were not text-based, right? They were like, you know, they were like buttons and switches and levers,
yep.
right? Like old style nuclear control panels or something. And this software metaphor was like put everything in a document. So that was new, but we thought that was obvious because you like to be able to read things. And then we thought, okay, hypertext is probably obvious. So there were a set of these things that we thought were obvious, but it's kind of like, okay, if they're so obvious, why haven't they happened?
Yeah. And I remember like, was it Vannevar Bush wrote something about, he talked about this thing called the Memex, I think, and it hypertext like in the 40s, maybe even like a long time ago.
So I started to do a lot of research. So luckily Illinois has a big library. So I started to do, and again, I was just stressed again, this is like pre Google. Like, so this is like go to the card catalog, right? And try to figure out like, Can I swear on this podcast?
Yeah, it's okay with me.
Okay, go to the card catalog if you're like, who the fuck wrote a book about this? Like, please, God, could somebody have written a book about this? So basically the history was tracing back in time, there had been Doug Engelbart, basically, who developed a lot of these ideas and demonstrated a lot of them working in prototype form in the late 60s. And so there was like an intellectual heritage going back to Doug. Contemporaneous, but even before that, was Ted Nelson, who had invented the term hypertext. And so there was this idea of linking that kind of existed. But like Ted is the guy who kind of picked up those ideas and kind of put them in the idea that a computer should be able to do this. And so there was kind of that heritage. And then there was, as you alluded to, there was this guy named Vannevar Bush, who in 1945 that wrote a paper called As We May Think, which is one of those great old style, 1940 style titles for papers. And it basically outlined a hypothetical system. This is 1945. So Vannevar Bush is an important guy. He was FDR's science advisor during the development of the nuclear bomb. And so he was like a very important guy. And he defined how the federal government would fund research for the next like basically 70 years. So this was like a very important guy, pillar of the establishment. So he wrote this document, which The Atlantic at the time published, back when they used to publish things like this. Today they'd publish a piece about how bad it is, but at the time they just like published a piece describing it. It basically outlined a system called MEMX, which is funny because 1945, so it's actually like pre-digital computer. Like digital computer was like a brand new idea.
Yep.
And he didn't, but like these ideas go way back.
Yeah.
You know, they're fairly obvious fairly quickly, right? Yep. You know, because it's like, okay, that would be a good idea. It'd be a good idea to be able to store large amounts of information, retrieve it, share it, transmit it over long distances, search it.
Yeah.
There we were sitting in like 1992 being like, okay.
Yep.
And so basically it's like, are we crazy, right? Is the rest of the world crazy or is it just the right time?
Yeah. And it's funny because it's one of, to me, you know, we both know this guy well, Balaji Srinivasan. One of the things I really like is his notion of this idea maze. I think Chris Dixon talks about it too. Right. It's, to me, it's a way better way to come at the question, because a lot of the, like all of it will happen someday. Right. And so the question is just, what's the right time for it to happen? And the idea maze is kind of this technique for understanding all the attempts that have occurred in the past and kind of understanding why those ideas got blocked. And now do they get unblocked all of a sudden? How do you decide what to build first and which ideas are worth pursuing?
So what we needed to have was a network effect. We needed to have a flywheel kick in. We did the browser. We also did the web server at the same time. And that web server actually now Apache is the modern descendant of that web server over the last 25, 30 years. And what we needed was kind of a ping pong effect, right? Where, because what you want is the flywheel, where like more people reading with the browser, at least more people wanting to publish with the server, the more people who publish with the server, the more incentive there is to read. And then you get the flywheel effect. And so what we needed for that, the advantage we had is we basically had a hack. One of the things we say at our firm is if you're going to start a new network effects are like the best businesses in the world, but to get a network effect going, to get through the bootstrap phase, you need some hack. You need some strategy to kind of get you through that initial phase to the flywheel catching. And so our hack actually was the NSFnet. But the other hack actually was at the time internet news groups. And so we're actually the carrier.
Yep.
And so it just like, it turned out, and this is one of those kind of stroke of luck things. It just turned out there was latent demand. There were enough people on this thing. They weren't, so it kind of goes back to the list. They weren't online at the same time, but they were online.
Yep.
And so there were enough people online where you could, there was a big incentive to be able to share, even if the small number of people who were there. And then there was a big incentive to consume if there was anything at all to read.
Yep.
And then this was like the prototypical early adopter crowd where they just like to try new things. And so there were a set of internet news groups that were kind of actively debating, discussing, all these kinds of topics. And so we were basically able to, just kind of use that as the carrier wave. One of the first blogs was a page I maintained. I wouldn't say it was the first one, not necessarily, but it was one of the first ones. So we had what was called the What's New page.
Uh-huh.
And the What's New page, literally, I would update it every, you didn't get into work and update it every morning, or say when I got into work late in the afternoon, as the case might be.
Probably started out as just everything that's there.
No, it's literally every new website, right? And it was literally like, I would just get emailed like, okay, I launched a new website that's got the menu of my favorite Indian restaurant in, Cardiff.
Yep.
I've got a new website that has, lyrics for the REM songs, right? Yep. It was just like random stuff like that.
Yep.
A lot of it was just people experimenting. And so it was literally, started out being like one a day. And I was like, okay. And then it started being two a day. And then it started being three a day. And then it went to 5 and 10, 20, 30 a day. And so and you could kind of, there were two ways to see the flywheel. One was the incoming email. There were two incoming email boxes where you could see the flywheel kick in. One was entries for the What's New page, because the What's New page was the main distribution method.
Yep.
It was the main way people were finding out about new web pages, right? Because this is pre-Google and everything else, pre-Yahoo. But the other email was customer support email for the browser, which was the thing that almost killed me.
Okay.
Was providing customer support for the entire internet. but that's another part of the story later on. So literally what happened was, this whole thing started taking off. The more and more people at Illinois started working on this, the team size started to expand. We became more ambitious. And then we actually went for the second round of NSF National Science Foundation funding. This is all happening. I was making minimum wage, $6.25 an hour, but that $6.25 an hour was being paid for by the National Science Foundation through a very generous grant. And I'm grateful for that.
At least you didn't get diluted.
No, yeah. it's hard to dilute $6.25 an hour, in fairness. They say keep your burn rate low.
Yeah,
that's a good way to do it.
Mission accomplished.
So literally what was happening was we were just working. And so we were the dog that caught the bus, you know, kind of thing, where it's just like literally what happened was, you know, the number of customer support emails per day was like, you know, 100 and then 200 and then 300. And then, you know, kind of up and to the right. So we went to NSF for grant number two to basically like, you know, basically make this thing real, like and kind of fully build it out. And of course they denied the grant.
Right. Well, we don't want to pay money to take all these support emails.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which is literally, and what I, at the time I was like, well, that's kind of, it's kind of, you know, they have a thing that's working and they're shutting off the money. Like, okay, that seems kind of dumb. And then I realized actually later on, I was like, oh, that was actually smart. Like, so specifically, like it's a research institute, it's NSF, it's research, it's intended to fund scientific research. And so clearly, yeah, customer support emails are like, you know, the 14th version of the Mac client, like it's not.
So maybe that's an initial sign of product market fit is when the university says, you know what, we're done with you using our resources here. You've outgrown this university.
Yeah, exactly.
That happened kind of with Google too, I think, later on.
Right. At some point, Google would have taken over the entire computer science department, eating all the computers. And it was, you get kicked out of the nest.
Yeah. So they were kind of pushing you out of the nest.
In retrospect, they did exactly the right thing. They did exactly the right thing at exactly the right time.
So did you decide, okay, I want to start a company? Nope. Or were you just like, well, that's a bummer. My grant money just went away.
The second.
Okay.
Of the two.
So now you're just answering customer support emails.
No, I was like, shit, I have to get a job.
Okay. So what year were you in college?
I was graduating.
Okay, so you're about to graduate.
It coincided with graduation.
Okay, okay.
It coincided right around that time. And I was like, well, shit, I got to get a job. And so like, and there, you know, basically there's not, you know, very, there's very little actually in Champaign-Urbana.
Okay. So now you got to get a job.
No.
You're interviewing for jobs.
Nope.
No? What was this? No.
Well, I had a slight advantage in my job search.
Okay.
Which is you
controlled Mosaic.
I controlled Mosaic. And specifically, I controlled Mosaic, which is like I got to decide what people saw.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And so I made sure they saw my resume.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. And so
a growth hack.
Yeah, it's a growth hack. It's a growth hack for your career. You just go in the browser and you add to the browser a button to see your resume. And so in fairness, I didn't put it on the homepage, which I could have done. That was a step too far, but I put it in the about page.
Okay.
I got a set of offers, some on the East Coast, some on the West Coast. I almost joined the Java team.
No kidding.
In 94. Yeah, 94 when I first came out here. But they offered
when it was called Oak.
It was called Oak at the time. It was Java pre-Java. At the time it was a spin out from Sun, but it was only a partial spin out. And so they offered me something called phantom stock options.
But it's also funny because all of us were thinking about, okay, there's going to be this network-centric future, but most people were framing it in yesterday's metaphor. They were talking about the digital superhighway.
Yeah, that's right.
And so as a result, people thought the center of gravity is going to be like set-top boxes and video game consoles. I don't know if others had this reaction, but when I first saw the Mosaic browser, it was instant ignition. This is how it's going to play out, right? I just immediately knew the way we've been thinking about this is wrong. It's not going to happen on these set-top boxes. It may someday, but like the browser is going to happen right here, right now. Like there was just no doubt in my mind, right?
Well, no. So what I would nominate on the point that you made, I think the point you made is an important point that we see all the time in our day job, and we see it all the time today, which is I would nominate two kind of dynamics to that. So top-down versus bottoms-up.
Yeah.
And one-way versus two-way.
Yep.
Right. And these are still battles that are playing out. I mean, this is, you know, the whole battle on cryptocurrency that's happening right now. Like, you see this all over the industry, all over the world, like this battle. And by the way, this is like many of global politics are based on this battle right now. And so top down versus bottom up, like the view at that time, right, it was the information superhighway. It was going to be, it was going to be set top boxes, interactive television, but it was going to be provided by big companies.
Yeah. Or should the government.
Or the government.
Yeah. Regular highway. Should they build a digital superhighway? And that'll help us against Japan, quote unquote.
Exactly. Right? That was the big thing.
That was the thought process.
That was going to take everything at the time. So, but it was going to be top down. And so the magazines and newspapers, 100% of the coverage, 100% of the commentary, like all of the media coverage, it was all around. It was going to be the government, or it was going to be Time Warner in those days, or AT&T, or Verizon, or, the big cable company with a predecessor to Comcast. And so it was going to be these giant media telecom companies, right? Yep. And then Microsoft and Oracle, giant software companies, were trying to kind of wedge their way in to kind of be part of it. This top down thing. But like they would decide what it was going to be. And then that goes to the second thing, which is one way versus two way, which is it was going to be primarily video, but like a one way push, mm-hmm. right? And so this is why the whole metaphor at the 500 channels, like the whole thing was, you've got like 14 TV channels, in the future you'll have 500. That's the information
center. And it'll be interactive TV.
Well, it'll be interactive TV.
You'll be able to push a button and order a pizza.
You'll have a remote control. Yeah. You won't have a keyboard, or a mouse, or anything that lets you get
into
trouble.
You'll just have a button that has a slice of pizza on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like we really had those.
Or like, American Idol. It'll basically all be like American Idol. It'll just be like, you can vote for the person who's, singing the best or something like that.
Yeah.
But the idea that an individual user was going to be contributing into this environment, the idea that an individual user would be publishing a video, right, or making a post, or anything like that, was just like setting up a website. There was no incorporation of that kind of two-way idea at all. I think what put the whammy on people was if you came from the established power structure, if you came from the big companies or the press that was used to covering the big companies, it obviously had to be top down in one way.
Yep.
Right. And by the way, the press was one way at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, this was before the audience could talk back. And so if you were a Time Magazine or NBC News or the New York Times, like you were used to.
You controlled the conversation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like maybe you published the occasional letter to the editor, but like you constrain that shit. Like you don't let people get carried away.
Yeah.
And that's, 1/48th of the space on, one page of the paper. So there was that. And so all the people who thought that they were in a position to decide had that view. But then all the regular people, right, or at least especially the nerds, including ourselves, the regular people, the people who were just like, look, I just want to be able to do things.
Yeah.
Right. And I want, by the way, do things. I want to be able to consume, but I also want to create and I want to contribute and I want to build.
If you are a product manager, growth leader, or even an engineer or founder, then I have a great podcast recommendation for you. Lenny's Podcast. Hosted by Lenny Richitsky, the author of the number one business newsletter on Substack with over 500,000 subscribers. This show features interviews with world-class product leaders and growth experts from companies like Stripe, Figma, Slack, Airbnb, and even the New York Times, so that you can learn from their hard-won experiences building and scaling some of today's most successful products. Lenny's Podcast is really for anyone who builds and grows software products for a living. So don't miss out. Follow Lenny's Podcast on your favorite podcast app, or you can check it out at lennyspodcast.com.
Yeah, and the thing that I've just seen time and again, it's like you think about it, when you were at the University of Illinois, you're hanging out with these supercomputers and you're building a browser. It's almost like the world was thinking in Cartesian coordinates and you were raised to only think in polar coordinates, right? And so like your mind was prepared to receive the insight because, like you said, you were living in the future. You may not have even known it at the time that you were living in the future, but it like so much of entrepreneurship I've found is it's like noticing. You're living in the future and you notice something and you solve your own problem. Yeah. And you're not necessarily trying to get rich at the time. You're just like, I'm working on cool stuff, and to do more cool stuff, I got to build this thing. So
what I found with myself, and what I found with the other founders who are like what you're describing, is it's just obvious. Like it's just like obviously this should be this way. But then there's like cognitive dissonance, which is like, if it's so obvious, why hasn't everybody figured this out yet?
Yeah.
Now, most of the time when people come to that conclusion,
they're just wrong
or insane.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
They have a vision, but it's like a hallucination vision.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But every once in a while, you've got somebody who really does decode something. And I think to your point on kind of the precondition conditions for it. Some of it is you get to see the early kind of pings. I was talking about, like, they're pings from the future is the other, yeah, the way that, like, they're, you can see these things actually running today. And so you get in a position where you can see something like that. So that's part of it. But the other thing that happens is you get to operate with the new assumptions.
Right. Right. When you're your age starting Netscape, you don't have to translate, right? Like, right, people who lived in Cartesian coordinates, they have to translate to go to polar, right? And so people who lived in the world of tops down, one way, digital superhighway, interactive TV, they had to translate that to what you were already doing, but to you it's just obvious, right? It's like there wasn't anything for you to unlearn.
Yeah. And then on top of that, I had no power, right? And so, like, I was not the CEO of AT&T. Like, I couldn't do any of the stuff that all these fancy people could do. I didn't have any that level of control. And so, like, anything that I was going to do was going to have to be bottoms up.
Yeah.
It was going to have to be two-way, like, kind of by if it wasn't two-way, I'd be blocked out.
So then, speaking of powerful people, how did you find Jim Clark, or how did you guys connect?
And this is where I got really lucky. So Jim Clark... Kind of quick recap. Jim Clark had been the founder and original CEO of Silicon Graphics, which was at the time, the company, as you said, you were there. It was the company at the time is probably most analogous today to, some combination of, Google and, it was the company. It was the company that all the smart, it was like, if you were a smart person in the computer industry, it was the company you either worked for or wanted to work for.
Yeah.
It was like the brain center of the industry. And this was when they really drove computer graphics to be what they are today.
Yeah. A total gee whiz company, right? Yeah. Best graphics engineers in the world, best networking engineers in the world, because you have to push the pixels over network. I mean, it was just an incredible place to be.
Fortunately for me, Jim had a problem. And the problem was Jim had grown very dissatisfied with the state of affairs at Silicon Graphics at the time. He got frustrated by a number of things. He left the company. He decided to start his second company. But he had a very specific problem, which was that he had a non-solicit at SGI. Mm-hmm. So he had spent the previous 15 years hiring all the smartest people he knew in the world into SGI, and now he couldn't take them with him.
Yep.
And so he literally had a warm meat problem, as in he didn't have any bodies to work with him. And so he literally went out to a whole bunch of people in the industry who he knew, who weren't at SGI, and he talked to them about maybe, you want to start something or work on something. And then he met me through a guy he worked with at SGI who I didn't know, but who knew about me. He was actually one of the guys at SGI who actually was responsible for all the demos.
Yeah.
They were a famous demo company.
Oh, yeah. That's how we sold our computers.
Yeah. And so the guy who ran I think it was designed the demos or built the demos for the briefing center, basically was like up on all the leading edge stuff because he was the demo guy. And so he basically knew about all this stuff. And so I apparently happened to mention to Jim that, like, A, that I existed, and that B, that I had just recently moved out here.
Yep.
And so, like, I get a random call from Jim Clark, like, one afternoon being like,
okay. Hey, did you know who he was?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, it's like literally, it's like, Steve Jobs calls you or,
you're like, this is
Larry Page calls you.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Larry Page. Would you like to talk about starting a new company? You're like, oh, okay.
You think?
All right. I don't know. Let me check my calendar, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm like, sure, name the time and place.
And so did you guys get on pretty well in the early days?
Yeah. So a couple of things happened. So one is, to my enormous shock, the other people he was talking to were too risk averse, and they didn't. And I should also, this was during a very sort of down period in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
This was not an exciting time.
Yep.
This was like 93, 94. So there had been a really big recession and a lot of companies had failed. And so there were a lot of people who just like wanted a job.
Yep.
But he did not get as nearly a positive response as I would have imagined.
Yeah.
From a lot of people who had like actual, had careers, let's say. And so through process of elimination, in part, I think it came down to me. And then he and I started brainstorming. And then we started working together on plans.
So he wasn't saying, I want Mark Andreessen because he invented the Mosaic browser. It's like, I can't get any of these killer SGI engineers. He's maybe another new smart guy that I can get and not get sued.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I think it's, he's probably just channeling Jim. He probably, at the very least, he knows how to build something new.
Yeah.
Which not everybody does. And so at least he's done it once before. But the reason why the Netscape idea was not obvious is because even after all of that, it still wasn't obvious that the internet would be a business, right? And part of that was it wasn't a business. Like, nobody had made it into a business.
Yeah.
And so there was just, it was just this thing, which is, it goes to the top down, bottoms up thing, which is just like, even after all that, and I saw the adoption cycle and the whole thing, and I stayed on all the mailing lists and I saw everything. It was just like, okay, like, I don't know, like, what are we going to, like, this is all open source. Like, you know, there's no commercial transactions on the internet. It had been illegal to do commercial transactions on the internet until 1993. Yeah. And this is only the spring of 1994. So it's, there was no e-commerce. There was no Amazon. There was none of that stuff.
Yep.
There was literally nothing to buy. There was no money. There was no nothing. Right. Yeah. And so it was just like, okay, it, there was not an obvious business to be built.
And I remember for couple of years, right? Upside Magazine at the time and things like that would say, you know, when's the internet going to have a business model?
Yeah,
right. For about 2 years, people said nobody's going to have a business model.
Yeah, this is absurd. Everybody knows this.
Even Yahoo, people said, well, great, but no business model.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And Google had no business model, like all these things. Yeah. None of these things have business models. Right. Exactly. So, so basically, and then Jim had been enmeshed, you know, Silicon Graphics had gotten enmeshed, in, two areas, that were, goes back to the conversation we're having about interactive TV. So, they were actually the provider of the technology for the Time Warner interactive TV project, which was like the most viable, it was the most actually developed version of the top-down information superhighway thing at the time in Orlando, Florida. This was written up in all the magazines and newspapers at the time. It was a really cool like system. It's kind of analogous to what you have today on a modern, you know, whatever Comcast or DirecTV set-top box or something. Heard like Netflix kind of experience in 1994. It was impressive. It was just, it was like the capital cost per house was like, I don't know, $60,000.
Yeah, it was crazy. We had some of our high-end gear, right, power those boxes.
It was not. So there was no, so we basically set out, plan number one was to build the software layer for interactive TV. And then we basically realized, oh shit, there's not going to be actually any interactive TV. Like the economics actually don't work.
Yep.
And then the other decision was SGI was building the graphics chip for the new Nintendo, at the time the Nintendo 64. The first game console with 3D graphics. So the idea basically was to build what today you'd call like Xbox Live or PlayStation Live, to build basically the network for Nintendo 64. The problem was Nintendo 64 was not going to ship for another 2 years. So literally we got to the point where they're like, okay, those two plans don't work. And then it was literally like, are we going to, like, what are we going to do? Process of elimination. Okay, so if top-down interactive TV isn't going to work and interactive gaming at that point wasn't going to work, then what's left?
Yeah.
What's left is the internet, right? And so it's like, okay, process of elimination, this thing that nobody's taking seriously, that nobody thinks can be a business, that breaks all the rules, that's bottoms up, that's organic. By the way, messy and hackers and crime.
And you like, probably don't even think it's a business yet.
No. Yeah. Well, now I have no actual business experience at that point. So I have no basis to evaluate anything in business. But however, it seemed like a stretch. But like, if it's the only thing, then it's going to win.
Right.
Because the only thing
is the thing.
Is the thing. Like, right. And so it was weird because Jim was like, oh, that makes total sense. And what Jim actually realized, I think to his credit, was he was so SGI was so powerful at that point that he was able. He was in that top down world, and I think he would say like he was so fully in it and of it that he thought that that was how the world was going to work, and he was doing his best to make it work that way when he did SGI. But then he's got such amazing sort of mental flexibility, which is extraordinarily rare to have somebody who's this flexible in their thought process. Where he was just like when he got into this new context, kind of just shedding assumptions, he was able to replant himself into a true startup context and able to shed all those assumptions and say, okay, from a standing start, what would you do, and come to a completely different set of conclusions.
So then you decide to start this thing, and you raise money from, well, he seed funds it at first. He's probably already been seed funding just your little vision quest.
No.
Okay. So you're just on this vision quest. You by process of elimination,
nights and weekends.
It's like, okay, we're doing this.
Yeah.
You just go raise money from John Dort, Kleiner Perkins, or
say we ran about six months with Jim. We ran about 6 months with Jim's money, and then Jim's like, you know, I'm rich, but I'm not that rich. And so he was like, we're time to go raise money. So Jim zeroed in on Kleiner Perkins because KP had actually backed Sun, which was SGI's big competitor, and he had always really respected how. Both companies ended up being very successful, but Sun had a much faster takeoff rate out of the gate. And then he had always respected how John went about being a board member at Sun.
Okay, so you raised some money for Netscape. Not sure if it's a business yet, but hey, let's go for it. And this must be around the time when Mosaic is starting to see even bigger lift, right?
Because I
seem to remember like the summer of 94.
Yeah.
It was starting to really become a thing.
So it was a snowball rolling down the hill, picking up speed. And it was starting to mainstream. And so you were starting to be able to, you're starting to get the first signs of consumers actually coming on the thing, which is normal people.
Okay.
Which is like a big deal at the time. You're starting to have companies starting to launch websites. So it was around that time. I think it was around that time that AT&T ran the first internet ad.
Yep.
On at the time, and because Wired had created a website and they ran the first internet ad on the first. The reason we have all these banner ads is because the first ad was a banner ad for AT&T on the Wired.com.
When did you switch from Mosaic to Netscape?
Mosaic had been the name of the project at Illinois. We didn't bring any of the code with us. The code was open source, but copyright University of Illinois. So we decided, and we needed to rewrite it anyway because we needed a bunch of stuff in the code like security that we didn't have. So we wanted to do a clean rewrite with what we knew now. But we did figure like it's the name of the research project. I knew Sun. The name Sun was actually named after the research project at Stanford. That spawned Sun was actually called the Sun Research Project.
Stanford University Network.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like, it's just like the name of the research project. It's a free thing.
Yep.
So it's just obviously we'll just call this thing Mosaic Communications. We'll figure out the product name later.
Yeah.
And then University of Illinois then did a very sort of clever thing I had not seen before. And I don't think I've seen since, which is they didn't sue us. Instead, they sent lawyers to all of our potential customers and told them they were going to sue us.
Ooh.
And so they freezed us in our tracks. They basically blocked our ability to do business because then they alleged basically a broad range of trademark and copyright violations. The copyright violations weren't true because we didn't take any of the code, but they threatened to sue us for that. And then we had this problem, which was we had this name, which there's some ambiguity as to whether there was a trademark on it or not. But like, yep. there did seem to be a clear
hard to explain there. Away.
Yeah. Just like inconvenient fact, yeah. as they say. And so we actually ended up suing them for, I believe it's, what is it, restraint of trade and purchase interference.
So are you feeling kind of pissed at them about now? Like thermonuclear
right about
super
now?
Pissed?
Now, like today, sitting here?
Even now.
Very much so, yes. Yes, I'm still extremely angry. Thank you for asking.
How does that make you feel, Mark?
Yeah, exactly. We'll pick that up in part two, the psychotherapy section of the thing. So we actually ended up suing them. And then we negotiated a settlement.
Okay.
And we paid them. And as part of the settlement, we changed the name.
Okay.
And that was the last penny.
So you changed it to you changed the name to Netscape. So you do the Netscape browser. Did it just immediately blow up? I mean, it was just everybody knew who you were. Everybody knew that you were the voice of browsers. So like what?
So that was a super fact. Well, it was this thing of it was basically a continuation of the Mosaic phenomenon, and we were the clear inheritors of that because we had built it, and so it was just one of these things where like it was a cold start as a company, but it was building directly on the momentum from the previous thing. And then we knew what else do we knew? We knew Illinois was not going to continue the Mosaic project because we knew they didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And so we kind of knew that it had to be picked up. And then look, the other thing was like there were just a set of things that you needed. Like it was time. It was time to be able to like do financial transactions, right? So it was time. Yeah. Like you needed encryption, which the original browser didn't have.
So was there any sort of palpable moment where you're just like, holy crap, this is blowing up? Or had it kind of already blown up even before Netscape really got started? Like, was there any moment where you're inside of Netscape and you're just like, holy shit?
Well, the big moment was the night of the original release of the browser where, you know, we hooked up one of the computers to the stereo system and had the Canon fire sound effect for every time somebody downloaded it.
Uh-huh.
And the Canon started to go off.
Okay.
Before long, the Canon was going off continuously, right? So
Like how long?
That was like that was a few hours.
Okay.
But I mean, but again, it was feeding on this moment. It was just like everybody... We knew everybody who was using Mosaic. We knew how to get to them. We just said, hey, there's this new thing.
Yeah.
It was much better. I mean, it was built correctly.
Yeah.
It was our second implementation.
So we
knew it was better.
Okay. And so now it's probably what? This is probably late 94?
Yeah.
Okay. 94. And so, and if I remember, you went public like in early 95. With no profits.
August.
Did you have any revenue yet?
Yeah. So we had revenue. We doubled revenue every quarter that year. So the revenue that year was, by quarter, was $5 million, $10 million, $20 million, and $40
million. Uh-huh.
And we went cash flow positive, like I think right around the time we went public. And I think we were, if I remember correctly, we were cash flow positive continuously.
Okay.
All the way to when we sold the company. So one of the legends, myths that built up around the company is that it was this early precursor for these unprofitable companies.
Really?
And actually, we actually prided ourselves at the time of like delivering cash flow.
Basically
through the whole thing.
So was the decision to go public pretty obvious then at the time? It was just like your revenues are exploding, people want the product.
It was obvious to Jim.
Okay. So like what's it like? So you're just barely out of college and all this stuff's happening around you. Like what's that like?
You know, it was just, it was literally, we were so heads down. It was just like, go work somewhere. It was one of those things. There was so much to do.
Yeah.
There was so much to do. I mean, it's like, it's building a company, which is incredibly hard. But on top of that, like the whole thing started to work. And then there's just like, you have like 1,000 ideas.
Yeah.
Right. And then it's just.
Well, and a few more customer support calls.
Yeah, and all that. Yeah. All this other infrastructure to build. And, you know, and then look, I'm learning business. I'm learning like basically all the business on the fly. Right.
Uh-huh.
I'm basically learning like, you know, I don't know, whatever is in an MBA plus another 10 years of operating experience.
Yep.
You know, in like as fast as I possibly can. Right. So I'm basically either like, I'm either at work or I'm like at home reading business books. Like those were the only two things that I did.
So now you know about the theories of product market fit and all that stuff. Like, how do you reconcile what happened at Netscape with the notion of product market fit? Like, because it just seems like one of these rare cases where it's just like lightning just struck and it was like huge right away.
I think for B2B, there are deterministic ways to try to get to product market fit. For consumer stuff, it's less clear to me even still.
Yeah.
We actually use the term lightning strike. It may just be. Well, here's one of the questions is like, there are quite a few companies that have had lightning strike consumer hits in the last 20 years. And that led to the creation of like very interesting companies. And there's probably, I don't know, in the U.S. alone, 50 or 100 or 150 of those, right?
Yeah.
How many of those ever had another one?
Yeah. Very few.
In the same company.
Yeah.
That they didn't have to go acquire from outside.
Yeah.
And I think it's
Apple?
Maybe zero.
Now people talk about the internet as being easy for hackers to get to, fundamentally insecure as an architecture or needs to be rethought in some ways. Knowing what you know now, are there things that you think you could have done or that Netscape could have done that may have made it play out a little differently?
Yeah, so there's three big things that we should have done that would have made a big difference early on. And one of them there's one thing we did that mattered a lot. I'll talk about that. There's one thing we tried to do and couldn't get there, which remains a hot topic today. And there's a third thing that didn't even occur to us, which I kicked myself. We didn't think about this, but I'll explain why we didn't think about it. So the thing that we did do is we got encryption in there.
That's huge.
And that was a fight then. By the way, it looks like it's going to be a fight again now. The various Western governments are once again pushing to try to restrict the use of strong encryption. Like people don't know the history of that, like we fought that battle. And Netscape Navigator was the first commercial implementation of encryption that became widely used.
Yeah.
There had been other products before, but we were the first one that millions of people used. And so we at the time we developed Netscape to have strong encryption. And the browser meant that the browser was classified under U.S. federal law with criminal penalties as ammunition.
Yeah.
It was classified in the same export control category as Tomahawk missiles. and so we were not allowed to export the version with strong encryption. We could sell it in the U.S. We couldn't export it. We had to export a weakened version.
Wow.
So imagine our sales pitch to a user in, you know, France or Australia or something is like, hey, congratulations, you get the one that's easy to crack.
Okay.
Yeah, you know.
U.S. government can have their way with it.
I hope you like it. Right, exactly. Yeah, and NSA has it pre-wired effectively because they could just crack it easily. And so we fought really hard in the 90s. There was encryption wars at the time. And ultimately, the government actually backed down. And as of like, was it 97 or whatever, they actually changed policy.
Yep.
And they actually eventually legalized strong encryption globally for U.S. companies to be able to build products globally. That battle keeps getting refought. And it has come, and probably in my view, it's come back to life. I think it's just an absurd thing to be. It's just like, do you want secure systems or not? Like,
right.
Could somebody please decide?
Right.
Do you want secure? If you don't want secure systems, fine. I guess we'll stop trying to build them. I guess they'll get built, you know, in other countries, and you know, the U.S. tech industry will not be relevant anymore. So that's an option.
Yeah.
But like, if you want American companies to win at tech, like maybe we should be able to build secure systems. And if you want us to be able to protect and defend the United States against cyber terrorism and criminals and all this stuff, you know, presumably that's a good idea. But anyway. We got that one in there. The one that we tried to do was integrated financial transactions. So payments, obviously, was something that you would want. And we tried to build that in. We tried hard there. The problem there is, you know, obviously money, payments, transactions that have been historically highly regulated.
Right.
And so we made arguably the mistake in that case of asking for permission, which is we went to the banks and the credit card companies.
Should have let the pirates go crazy.
Probably. The problem was we didn't have the technology yet. We didn't have Bitcoin. We didn't have cryptocurrency. Yep. This was pre-cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
And so had we let the pirates go crazy, we would have had to just implement a system that just let you transfer money with like no permission.
Yeah.
And probably we would have gotten nuked for that.
That would have even been worse than the encryption.
Yeah, like PayPal figured out a way to bootstrap a system, you know, a few years later, but, you know, they almost died. Like they came close to dying.
Yeah.
They almost got regulated out of existence. They just barely got through it. And so that was the big one that like we should have had and we missed, but we did try. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so strong now, so positive on cryptocurrency and blockchain and Bitcoin and Ethereum and all these things today. It's just like internet scale money and trust needs to happen.
Yeah.
It was a huge problem that we didn't have it early. Had we had internet scale money and trust wired in early, like the internet economy today would not be based on advertising,
yep.
right? It would not be based on any of the privacy stuff that people are worried about today. It would be based on money and trust.
Yeah.
And it would be a fundamentally better, stronger system. Our view is with cryptocurrency, we have a chance to go back and kind of redo that.
Yeah.
Now, of course, they're trying to, in various forms, keep that from happening as well.
Yeah.
They. But we're going to try. And then the one that I wish we had had, but it didn't even occur to us as real names.
Okay.
Real identities.
Oh, right? Interesting.
Right? Which is okay. The other part of trust, right? Which is like, okay, who are you dealing with?
Yep.
Right. And so all the issues, you know, spam and fraud and like all these issues, abuse and harassment, all that stuff. Like it's basically, you can't solve any of that stuff if you don't have real names. Hmm. And so, I mean, it's hard enough to solve those problems when you have real names.
Yeah.
It's impossible to do it if you don't have real names, I think.
Okay. Well, good. Thanks, Mark.
Good. Thank you, Mike.
It was great talking to you. Thanks for listening to Starting Greatness. You can follow me on Twitter at M2JR, and please shoot me an email with any comments or questions to greatness@floodgate.com. I hope you'll subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the show, I'd be grateful if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Never let go of your inner power to do great things in whatever matters to you. And until we meet again, remember, greatness is a decision.